and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Real Talk is the show that seeks answers to questions large and small. We're here every Tuesday at noon. Thank you for joining us. Today, the question is, how does breath affect our health? And the person I've brought to answer that question is Robert Littman, creator of The Breathable Body, and a 30-year practitioner of working with people on their breath and their movement. Welcome, Robert.
Well, hi, Susan.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So you say that how we breathe has a strong relationship to our general health. What can you tell us about that?
Well, how we breathe determines how the body's chemistry metabolizes air that we bring in. In other words, when we breathe in nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon dioxide. And how we breathe determines the ratio of those three things in our body. We need them to be in proper ratio for oxygen to be equally distributed throughout the body to support the health of all of our organs. And when we breathe incorrectly, for instance, like using a mouth for breathing instead of a nose for breathing, we debilitate that process. We reduce the ability of the body to actually deliver oxygen deep into our cellular body.
It seems to me that would be a natural thing to do correctly. How is it we humans get to the point where we're not using our breathing most efficiently for health?
Well, a couple of things. One is, somebody gets sick, gets a really bad flu, and their nose is stuffed a lot, and they start to go to mouth breathing. And they begin a habit of using their mouth for breathing, or some trauma happens and scares them and they use their mouth for breathing. And then they report that their nose is stuffed most of the time. So then they say, well, I can't breathe through my nose because it's stuffed all the time. The phenomenon about that is the more you use your mouth for breathing, the more the nose gets stuffed. If you start to retrain yourself to be able to tolerate nose breathing for a period of time and not feel so much oxygen hunger, because people who take mouth breaths take really big breaths. So when you switch to nose breathing, you're taking smaller breaths. Smaller breaths are just as efficient or more efficient than larger breaths, but people have this sense in their body, I can't get a big breath. I can't get a big breath. And so then they continue to repeat that pattern. And over time, it is debilitating. Taking a big breath is like hyperventilating over and over and over again.
That kind of breaks a myth.
Yes.
I think most of us think that good breathing is about taking in a huge breath. So what is it about that slower rate of breathing or the smaller breaths that actually serve our physical functions better?
Well, let's just talk about it from a nose breathing aspect. So what I like to talk about is, it's such in a common way in this country right now and around the world, we're looking at climate change. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's driving climate change is a higher level of carbon dioxide. So forgetting about numbers higher or lower, the ratio between those three gases in our atmosphere is beginning to change. And so we're seeing weather disturbances. When we take really big breaths, we blow out a lot of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide's gotten a bad rap, in with the good, out with the bad. But actually, carbon dioxide, in a very complicated way, regulates the distribution of oxygen from the blood to the cells. So when we breathe out through our mouth a lot, we dissipate the levels of carbon dioxide. We upset that ratio of oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide in our body. And as a result of having less oxygen distributed, most importantly to the brain, we start to see symptoms show up.
Like
anxiety, can't catch a big breath, feeling out of breath, breathless, sleep apnea starts to arise through a pattern of holding the breath, trying to get more air, asthma, allergies. What happens when the body is not getting its full complement of oxygen is actually in a state of starvation. And when it's in a state of starvation, that's a very high stress for the human body. So one of the things that happen is the immune system gets overactive, and it can lead to people who normally can smell a rose or smell a gardenia all of a sudden find the pollens intolerable because the immune system is so overactive, it just can't tolerate anything. So it starts to block the inhalation of pollens by stuffing the nose and making you sneeze a lot to get it all out of the body. When the body's healthy and its breathing chemistry and nervous system and the immune system are in balance, for most people, those allergies start to settle down. And asthma can tend to come from allergies. It comes after people are allergic. Mm-hmm. So all of that sort of backs off. The other piece of that is, a couple of pieces, the other one of them is that when we breathe out through our nose, our sinuses retain two-thirds of the level of carbon dioxide that our body breathes out. So when we breathe back in, we're breathing back in our old carbon dioxide, which keeps the balance in order. So the example of that that people know generally is when somebody's about to faint because they've been hyperventilating really actively, they give them a paper bag to breathe into, which means they breathe back their own carbon dioxide and it stops the fainting. Why were they going to faint? Because of the excess of the carbon dioxide outside the body, the brain starts to get less oxygen and you start to pass out. So with carbon dioxide coming back in, it releases the oxygen from the blood and the brain comes back awake.
That's a very scientific explanation of something we've all lived with and known to be a simple remedy. And I'm wondering how your work with breath works with or is accepted by the traditional Western medical community. Do you collaborate in any way?
Well, actually, yes. There's so much being published now. You know, it's always like I was talking to somebody today who was in another field, and he said he was walking in the wilderness for many years, and now that particular thing is in the front of the public eye. Same with breath. I've been doing this for 30 years, and back then nobody was paying attention to breathing. And now you can go, you can buy breathing apps, you can buy apps to calm you down, to listen to music, all of which are designed to slow your breathing down, to relax the nervous system so the body can actually breathe on its own without you controlling it and manipulating it. And that's what most people do. They take a breath or they force their exhale. Breathing is meant to be something that's so far back in your awareness, you don't even notice you're doing it because the body just does it regularly on its own.
Yeah.
But most people who report they can't take a big breath, they are reporting that because breath is becoming a problem for them. They're noticing something internally is not working right. They're not breathing right.
So this isn't something that happens overnight to a person?
No, generally it's a habit that gets built. It comes in two ways. One is an actual breathing mechanic habit, like breathing through your nose and breathing through your mouth. Breathing through your mouth instead of your nose, that's a mechanical process that can be changed and retaught. Another is the idea of, I need to take big breaths because I've been taught to take big breaths. That's a belief system that's driving a breathing rate that's not actually beneficial to the body.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So how do you train people to use breath to handle things like asthma, allergies, sinus issues?
Well, that's good. I work with people now more privately, and I have some equipment now that's been developed to help people see their breath on the computer called the capnometer. So they get to see what they're breathing is erratic, how often they're inhaling, how often they're exhaling, how much their blood chemistry is changing from breath to breath. And so by this biofeedback, I can help retrain them to relax into a different pattern, into a different habit. I'm trying to break an old habit and reinforce a new habit that internally feels much healthier. They find themselves having less symptoms, less allergic, less anxious. Anxious is the big one right now. Most people are feeling really anxious.
For a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons.
Nationally.
Right. It's true. And so those things, that's an entry point into anxiety, are mental fears about things. But the other entry into anxiety is using your mouth for breathing. When, you know, I always tell the same story, basically. If a bear would come through the room into the door, when you were sitting there, you'd go, ah! You take a big gasp of air through your mouth and you'd be in fight or flight immediately. You'd be narrowing your vision. You're not worrying about the weather anymore. You're worrying about the bear. Your heart rate's pumping a mile a minute. You're starting to get pale. You may get some tingling in your hands and feet and face. And so you're in a hyperventilation state, but you're very alert. You're in fight or flight. So the same thing happens with our mental fears. If we're worried about things for the future, we will gasp for air with our mouth and open our mouth to breathe. And that triggers that autonomic nervous system to be in fight or flight. It's sort of like unavoidable. Use your mouth for breathing, you're triggering fight or flight.
Yeah, so which comes first, the anxiety or the mouth breathing?
No, well, they kind of feed each other.
It's a circular thing.
Yeah, well, don't you think it's curious in society today, everybody's talking about being present? And so yes. Being in the moment, and what the point of that is, of course, is the moment does not have the mental fears in it, or doesn't the reality that I'm sitting in this room with you, I'm not worrying about my bank account, I'm feeling the air on my body, I'm looking at your face, we're having a discussion,
yeah.
So I'm right here with what's here right now. I'm sitting alone and I start to worry about my bank account, or I start to worry about what's happening, global warming, all those things, and then my body gets worked up by those mental fears. So a human race is evolving into or trying to develop is a nervous system that can stay present, that knows the difference between what is a thought-produced fear and what is a real viable threat right now. So our nervous systems developed over time, over a 500 million year period, which in the first development was freeze. The bodies froze so that animals were attacking them and they played dead.
Oh.
250 million years ago came about fight and flight. The animals going, wait a minute, I can run away, or I can actually fight this little creature who's threatening my life. And So that developed. So now we're trying to develop this other part of our nervous system, which can stay quiet, even in the face of, oh yeah, that's a mental thought. I'm staying present with what's here with me right now. So we're trying to rewire ourselves. And that's why you see so much about presence in the world right now. The sociological aspect is we're trying to be present.
Is that something that is more peculiar to Western society than it is to Eastern society? And I ask this because you mentioned the idea that we're all trying to be more present, which, to my understanding, is more of an Eastern philosophy that we're beginning to adopt here in Western culture, primarily for health.
Yeah.
How does your breathable body training dovetail with things like meditation meditation?
Yeah, well, meditation is an intervention. I'm going to intervene with this technique to get myself to be quiet. I'm more interested in you knowing how to self-regulate. So the meditation can turn into a self-regulation, because you notice in meditation, oh yeah, when I'm in meditation, I relax my shoulders. Oh, so I notice when I'm anxious, my shoulders are up around my ears. If I drop my shoulders, I don't need to meditate, but it shifts my entire breathing and it brings in more relaxation. So I'm looking to see and teach people how to self-regulate. So in my work in movement, it's never one thing or the other. It's how to move from one thing to the other. So if I find myself anxious, what skills do I have to self-regulate to move to a quieter state? And those are tools that I carry with me all the time. I don't have to go sit someplace. I don't have to meditate someplace. I can make that shift with my breathing in one or two breaths.
When you talk about movement in association with the breathable body,
mm-hmm.
I understand the breathing part. Tell us more about the movement part.
Okay, so my company name is The Breathable Body. Let's take a look at it from that aspect. We live in a reductionist society where either this is wrong or that is wrong. In breathing, the entire body is moving when breathing. In your inhale, everything moves. And when you exhale, everything moves in an opposite direction. It has to. If you think about it this way, the lungs are in a body which is a finite container. When they are filling with air, they are getting larger, which means they push all that soft tissue around. So our body is completely responsive to the movement of breath. When we are resistant to that, and everybody has resistances from old traumas, from fears, from ways they think they should behave, children sit still, don't move, we start to tighten up our bodies and tighten up our tissues. Well, when breath tries to come in and move against that tightening, it can't. So our capacity for taking a healthy breath is reduced. And so when our capacity for breathing is reduced, our body is not so breathable. We have to breathe faster to get as much air as we need. When the body is more relaxed and open and receptive to movement of breath, breath slows way down. So you can ask anybody who's taken a yoga class at the end of an hour of yoga, yes, where you've stretched and you've moved and they lie you down for that last little bit. It's like, am I breathing? I don't even feel like I'm breathing. I don't even think I am breathing. I have to remember to breathe. No, you're breathing at how you're supposed to be. For those of us who've had children, when your child is lying in that bed in the early stages, you mothers and fathers have been very frightened that their child, yes, is not breathing, right? Because they're so relaxed. They don't have all of that history that older people have of going through life and being frightened and having this happen and that happen. They're just visceral beings breathing and letting everything just relax onto the bed. So it's very quiet, and that's how breathing should be. So when we talk about how we breathe, one of the questions is, do you hear yourself breathing or do you not hear yourself breathing? You should never hear yourself
breathing. You don't want to hear yourself
never
breathing.
Never hear yourself breathing. If you hear yourself breathing, you're working way too hard and there's way too much resistance.
That's an important point.
Right.
You're listening to Real Talk on The Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm talking with Robert Littman, creator of The Breathable Body, How We Breathe, the relationship between breathing and health. And we can do this thanks to Windermere Vashon Real Estate. They support all our community information programming, and they make our emergency alert service possible. Robert.
Yes, Susan.
How does the whole idea of the breathable body and slowing your breath work with physical exercise, strenuous physical exercise?
It's a good question, because most people feel like when they exercise, they breathe faster, or they have to breathe faster to keep
harder,
up.
Yeah.
Harder, right. And the question is, since breathing produces the movement in the body, is your movement coordinated with a sense of feeling like the breath is moving my body? I can move from the will of how I think I should move, or I can allow the breath to inform my movement because I feel it in response and it wakes up all the tissues so I know how to use my body in a much more conscious way. When I'm using it more consciously, breathing and breath work, breathing and exercise work hand in hand. So I have nice pictures of the world's fastest woman at a quarter mile picking up gold medals in the Olympics. 440 yards, full out, fastest woman, never opens her mouth to breathe, breathing through her nose the entire way. Now, granted, it took her a while to learn how to do that.
I was going
to
ask that,
right.
Yeah.
But, you know, it can be done, and I've worked with many people who've gone on really strenuous hikes, and in 3 days they say, wow, I'm able to adapt and breathe through my nose the whole way, because it's an allowing process. It's not a manipulating process. Can I allow my body to move in a way, open and close in a way that supports the size of breath that I need at a particular time? If I'm moving fast, the body will have larger capacity because it's more relaxed, and so I can take in more air. If I'm holding myself really tight and I'm exercising, I'm going to be out of breath really fast.
So I could get to the point where I can go up a hill fast and not be going with my mouth wide open?
Yes, you can.
Wow.
Yeah, take some training, not much, but a little bit. And so the trick there is to, when you start to notice you use your mouth for breathing, you slow down. The rule of thumb that we use here is you breathe through your nose, you breathe through your mouth as often as you eat through your nose.
I love
right?
that.
You heard that before. And the other is you pace yourself in your activity level so you can use your nose for breathing all the time. It is the barometer, so to speak, for your activity level and your breathing. If you find yourself moving so quickly that you have to use your mouth for breathing, then you're moving too fast.
What about swimming?
Swimming is the same thing. Now, I've been swimming for like 65 years now, and it can be done. I've done it, but mostly when I feel like I've gotten myself too wound up, I flip on my back and breathe through my nose and swim the backstroke. So I vary it.
So you can do a crawl and turn your head and breathe through your nose, not through your mouth.
It is the epitome of relaxed in the water, trusting that you are not going to drown, that you're totally buoyant and supported in the water, and having a breathing rate that is so slow that it doesn't jam up those water molecules in your nose. See, even with stuffed noses, there's always room to breathe if you can find the size and volume and ribbon of breath that will go through the stuffed nose. I've had people come in and go, I can never breathe through my nose. It's totally stuffed. I talk to them about nose breathing. Then I talk to them for 5 or 10 minutes, and the whole time they're there, they're breathing through the nose. And they came in saying, I can never breathe through my nose.
So it's an awareness issue.
It is. Well, and part of it is like, I entitled this How We Breathe, and I'm going to put a plug in for myself because I'm doing a free lecture and demonstration and teaching at the Vashon Theater on March 3rd at 1 o'clock. So we're going to talk about some of these things, and I'm going to show you how to engage these healthier ways of breathing. And one of them, again, is do I use my chest for breathing or do I use my diaphragm for breathing? So if I'm using my chest for breathing, I am way in efforting too much for breathing. And more than likely will start to go to my mouth for breathing. The diaphragm needs to be the muscle that invites the breath through the body, not me trying to take a big breath.
I've noticed that, the diaphragmatic breathing, most in singers,
mm-hmm.
who apparently need to learn how to use the diaphragmatic breathing in order to get the volume and the tone that they need.
That's right.
To use their voice as an instrument.
That's right. Yes.
How do you use your breathable body training for to help people with psychological or emotional issues?
That's a good question. It's an awareness issue. It's taking a look when they can settle down after I teach them how to use their belly for breathing. You know, mm-hmm. let the diaphragm pull the breath in, slowing down the rhythm, using the nose for breathing. The system settles, and when the system settles, what needs to be seen that has been hiding behind an erratic breathing pattern starts to come to consciousness. And so they can begin to talk about it. If it's really severely emotional and out of my scope of practice, I'll refer them out to a therapist.
Mm.
But you'll know immediately what's driving. When you relax into it, you'll start to see what's driving. Memories will come up. It's what's challenging for people who want to learn how to breathe in a way that supports their health. That you're opening a door that has a lot of side passages to it that need to
emotional be emotional baggage.
Yeah, emotional baggage, which is really an interesting thing about that, because when you take time for breathing every day, even if you just take 5 or 10 minutes, and actually the studies show 20 minutes now that help regulate the parasympathetic nervous system for rest and settle, you train yourself to be able to access your quieter body more easily. And it gives you a chance to process. I think I answered the question. Maybe I lost track a little bit of that question.
No, I think you're still with it. To uh-huh. process. So if I'm using quieter breath
mm-hmm.
to slow me down throughout my day.
All right, baggage.
Am I going to be stricken with baggage at the wrong time? At a bad time?
Well, no, it's an interesting thing. It's like knowing yourself well enough to go, you know, I need to take some time for myself. Things that we take in so many impressions during a day, and we have so many responses to those impressions, and we don't always have time to see what those responses are.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're quiet in ourselves, which is the point of meditation, when we're quiet in ourselves, we go, oh, yeah, I remember that person cut me off on the road. I'm really angry about that. I have a moment to actually have that response that I didn't have earlier. And so now that's emptied out.
Ah.
And so I remember when I'm 74 and, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you didn't want to get in a relationship with somebody who had a lot of baggage, right?
Right.
That was
yeah.
the conversation.
Yeah.
Well, now the question is, can I empty my baggage out every day instead of going from from day to day to day carrying it? So it's sort of a felt sense that says, I'm really getting tense, I'm tight, I'm anxious, I'm irritable, I'm nervous, whatever it is. I need to take some time for myself and I can access it through my breathing. So it's a contemplative process about what's going on in my internal landscape. And my breathing, as Dr. Dyer used to say, is the easiest access, because if I put my awareness on my breathing, it takes me inside. And once I go inside, I know what my internal world is all about, if I'm willing to take the time to pay attention to it.
It is so much about paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have people come to you for this training who don't buy into the idea or don't want to do that kind of work?
Not generally, because if they're coming to me, they're already on board to want something to be different than it is already. It's not that it's always easy for them. Not everybody then says, well, it follows the regime of homework that I give them. But I also have learned that people work at their own pace. I've had people come in who don't do the homework and then come back a year later and want the second piece and now say, hey, now I'm ready to do the homework, you know? So everybody works at their own pace. I don't press people to have to achieve a certain result by a certain date.
So if we attend your presentation on March 3rd at the Vashon Theater at 1 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
Are we going to be enticed to come and learn from you? Or are we going to be able to walk away with some new understandings of how to handle our breathing?
Both. I really feel like it's a gift back to humanity. It's something that's being missed, and there is a humanitarian aspect of me that wants everybody to be healthy. So I'm very willing to give enough education that people can go home. And that's always been the case when people come back from my lectures. They say, I got so much out of that lecture. And if you want to go further, then you come see me. Especially if you're not feeling well and you do have some challenges like sleep apnea or allergies or asthma or anxiety, or your heart is not working in a regular beat. And fibromyalgia, all of those things. When I learned this from Dr. Pateko, he got accepted into the Russian medical system. That's where this came from, because he claimed that he could help 150 different diseases. And they challenged him on that. And they asked, he said if he had an 80% success rate, they would accept it in the Russian AMA. And he had 100% success rate.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, you just think about it. It's the major nutrient we have to take in. If we're undernourished, things cannot be working right in our bodies.
You know? What's your relationship with the American Medical Association? How do they see this?
I personally don't have one because I am not a doctor, and Buteyko has not been studied here in this country. But there are so many adjunct pieces happening right now, like SMU, Southern Methodist University, a couple team, a wife and husband team, did a huge NIH grant to validate this particular phenomenon of low CO2 producing a huge amount of symptom picture, and so especially anxiety. So other fields are taking on their way of dealing it. They use biofeedback, which is now what I'm using also.
Right.
Yeah.
Robert Littman, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Ah, time went fast.
It does go fast. There's always more to the story.
Right. That's why you have to come out on March 3rd to the Vashon Theater.
That's right.
And
1
it's
o'clock.
Free. It's from 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to Real Talk. It's the show that seeks to answer questions large and small. We're here every Tuesday at noon. Thank you for joining me. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. And if you've got some questions you would like answered, send them to me at realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. Thanks for listening. I'm talking with Mary Fran Lyons, our version of Nancy Perlman here on Voice of Vashon, for a Real Talk special, Lyons on Lit. She's going to talk with us today about a book titled Libby, The Journal of Libby Beeman. Welcome, Mary Fran.
Thank you for having me. So this book is named Libby, and it's the subtitle is The Sketches, Letters, and Journal of Libby Beeman Recorded in the Pribilof Islands, 1879 to 1880, as presented by her granddaughter, Betty John. And I picked this up in a bookstore. It's got to be the better part of 30 years ago. And it's a book that has just absolutely stayed in my mind because it's such a dramatic book. I mean, just hearing the description of it does not sound very exciting, but I will tell you that this journal is written by a woman who grew up in Washington, D.C. during the Civil War. She met Abraham Lincoln at one point. She mentions that in the book. And then as she got older, she met her husband, and that was a very unusual circumstance, and I'm not going to go into that. You should read the book to find out how they had to finesse that little piece. But the gist of the book is when she accompanied her husband to one of the Pribilof Islands in 1879, a very unusual thing. These agents would go out and they would be counting the number of fur seals that would be harvested. And nowadays it's a pretty gruesome thing. So these people would go out to the islands and here would be these beautiful little seal pups, and they basically were not afraid of humans, and they'd walk up to them and just club them over the head and take the fur. I mean, it just sounds horrible, but it was really the beginnings of conservation because these agents would be sent out there to basically count the number of seals that they were taking. Anyway, she was there. It was new in their marriage, and so she went with her husband, and it was a big novelty. And so she went to this island and stayed there over the winter. And if you get the right edition, there are some drawings of different things. There are some descriptions of what the Native Americans were doing, how they lived, some of the issues with them, descriptions of the seals, some of the practices. There's some pretty major drama about just getting through the winter in and of itself. So it's a book that on the surface would not look too exciting, but I have to say, when I read it, I was totally riveted and have never forgotten it. And if people say, give me a good book, it's always one of three that I'll recommend. Of course, then it has the added advantage that it's some local color for the Pacific Northwest.
Is it still in print after 30 years?
You know, that's actually a very interesting question, because I think I went on Amazon not too long ago to see if it was. And I'm not sure it's in active printing, but it was originally published in 87. So I think I probably picked it up, you know, in the early 90s or something like that. I was up here on a trip and I was in a bookshop and I thought, well, that looks interesting. And I picked it up and it's really just a wonderful sort of, I mean, I would almost say it would be a little bit like going to the moon in the Pacific Northwest, in the sense that it's such a different time, but, you know, such a different place. Maritime, conservation, just all kinds of issues that are still very much with us today.
Well, maybe one could order it from the Vashon Bookshop as well.
You could order it from the Vashon Bookshop, and I'm very sure you could get it through the library.
Okay.
So.
And so the title of the book again?
Is Libby, as presented by her granddaughter, Betty John, who has edited and really organized this in a very readable way.
Thank you very much, Mary Fran Lyon.
Thanks for having me.
This is Lyons on Lit as part of Real Talk. It's a special for Real Talk.